Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm John Peters Coleman, and this week we take a look at alternative comedy around Bristol this Christmas and New Year. Also, Anthea Page is forging links between Bristol and a radio station in war-torn Colombia, 5,000 miles away in South America. We'll look at Bristol bullying and a Bristol bullying helpline, which mainly helps school children who are being bullied and their parents. And I'll also talk to David Saunders, who wants to talk about the community energy revolution and how it's impacting Hamilton House and Stokes Croft. Also coming up later on, Malcolm Greaves reads this week's episode of Treasure Island, and of course we have the What's On Guide and Song of the Week. Dialect is produced by volunteers and broadcast in Bristol on BCFM 93.2. Hello also to my listeners on Preston FM up north and in St Albans on Radio Verulam. If you want to join in and you're in the Bristol area, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square, and we'll give the details out at the end of the show. Okay, it's my pleasure to introduce Mr. David Saunders to the studio. Hello.
Hello, John.
So you have an interest in certainly green energy, but also sustainability generally. Explain your background. When did you start being interested in this?
About 10 years ago, when I was working as a corporate consultant, and I realised that the corporations I was helping weren't necessarily making people healthier or happier, and it just didn't seem to be much fun anymore just to help them make more money. I wanted to see, you know, what can we do to help our communities live more sustainably?
Okay, where did you start in your journey, your quest?
Yeah, and I didn't even know what that meant at first, but what I did first was a permaculture course up in Lancashire, which was wonderful. It was about growing food without any chemicals and very much in tune with the land. But I thought, you know, you can't quite take that into a boardroom.
Okay.
And then I learned about something called, after a bit of a search, I learned about something called zero emissions, which is about doing any process without waste.
Okay.
And strangely, I was invited to be the marketing manager at the largest environmental pavilion at the World Expo in the year 2000 in Hanover.
Fantastic. What a bit of luck.
Yeah, it was great. We had this wonderful bamboo pavilion, and we were showing people examples from around the world of doing things without waste.
Right.
The best example of which, the one I liked best, was a pig farm. Mm-hmm. Well, the idea that you take cattle waste and you, instead of putting that in a pond and it just ruins the groundwater, you put it through an anaerobic digester. It creates energy, it creates fertilizer. From the liquid, you grow algae.
Okay.
The algae you put in the pond and you grow fish.
Okay.
In something that was a slurry pond before.
So fast forwarding a few years and you're still interested in green energy, but in an urban environment, perhaps pig farms are not necessarily in abundance in the Stokescroft area, and you bumped into Hamilton House.
Yeah, I started working with the owners of Hamilton House about 4 years ago, and the idea then was, what can you do in an urban environment to improve the community?
Yeah.
And we talked to the people in Stokes Croft, and they typically said, well, we need cheap studio space, actually, because it's an artistic area.
Yeah.
And so the building has been turned over into lots of different uses and a thriving cafe, and there's yoga and dance and drumming and all kinds of things going on there. And about a year ago, we started to think more about the energy use in the building, and I started to look very specifically at solar energy.
Okay, what are the costs involved if one place decides it wants to put solar energy panels on its roof?
Well, a few years ago, solar panels were very expensive, and in the last few years, they've come down. And I was in Germany and discovered that you could buy the panels for about £2,000 a kilowatt. So that's about four solar panels, about 7 square meters.
Okay.
And that seemed to me quite a good price. And you get, in Bristol, you get about 1,000 hours of sunlight equivalent a year.
Okay.
So that would make about £125 worth of electricity at 12 pence a unit.
Okay, brilliant. And normally everything is, of course, taxed. I mean, is there any kind of a tariff that is placed upon you because you've decided you want a certain panel?
No, it's the opposite. At the moment, the government have been providing an incentive that's been called a feed-in tariff, and they pay you for every unit of energy that you create.
Oh, fantastic.
And that's intended to help finance the scheme.
Right, okay. Obviously, the cuts are in abundance at the moment, and I guess this also possibly affects tariffs. Would I be right?
Ooh. Absolutely. As of December the 12th, as of Sunday, the tariff dropped to a half. But during the last year, the cost of solar panels has also dropped to a half. So while there's been, across the country, there's been a doubling and a doubling again in the number of solar panels installed. I think it will slow down a bit. But actually, what is it, 21 pence a unit is more than you pay for electricity, and it's more than enough to pay for the cost of installing solar panels.
Okay. I hear a lot about various one-off projects installing solar panels, but I mean, we really need more than just the occasional building and a few well-meaning people to really get across what you've described as a community energy revolution. How is that actually going to happen?
Yeah, well, we didn't install drains one house randomly at a time, and we didn't build our railways a mile at a time. I think it makes sense if you install solar panels a whole street at a time. The cost will come down, the installers will come start at one end of the street, the kids will get involved, and there'll be a kind of energy about it. And that's why we set up a co-op to think about doing that. And we've just got a grant from Bristol City Council to explore, now that we've got solar on a community centre, from that base we're going to explore putting solar on a whole street, and hopefully that will become a model for other people to accelerate the solar revolution.
If people listening to this sort of quite excited about that, can people sort of get involved and take an interest and find out more?
Well, we've got two websites, and one is about this campaign, and it's just the idea really, and it's called streetsofsolar.org.
Okay.
And you can have a look at that and join in. It's right at the beginning, and Bristol Power Co-op is our website, is bristolpower.coop.
Okay. As a corporate consultant, I guess you're quite a good person to ask. I mean, when a lot of things were privatised in the 80s under Thatcher, we were told that obviously in regard to electricity there'd be better choice and lower prices. What do you think has happened over the past 30 years?
Well, it costs about 4.6 pence to make a unit of electricity from fossil fuel. And on average, people are paying 12.7 pence for a unit of electricity, almost three times as much. I think you can draw your own conclusion, really. What the energy industry does very efficiently is rack up the profits.
Okay, what happens realistically if mass advancement of solar panels goes out? They're not going to be paying the same tariff to everybody if it becomes very popular, are they?
It'll take quite a while before solar panels on people's roofs really affects the energy industry, but I think it will grow and grow and grow, and alternative energy will have something like the same revolution in energy that we've had in information in the last decade.
A criticism commonly of environmental methods of electricity production is that it also involves a lot of energy and nasty chemicals to make the things which are providing the green energy in the first place.
Yeah, solar panels are actually pretty clean. They're a sheet of glass. They've got some silicon chips in them, which is basically fried sand. And they're surrounded by aluminium, which is one of the most commonly occurring elements. And all of these things can be made with renewable energy. The best panels, some come from Sweden, where they're made with hydroelectric power as the original energy source.
Okay, what advantages might they have over other forms, for example, wind?
Wind's lovely, but it starts and stops. Solar is very regular. You get it during the day. People will design storage systems so to keep you over the night. You get more wind in the winter, which is a great thing, more sun in the summer. So we'll end up with balancing things.
Balance of things. Okay, remind us of the websites if people are interested in finding out more about the Bristol Power Co-op.
Well, bristolpower.coop, pretty easy. Yep. www.bristolpower.coop and streetsofsolar, all one word, .org.
Well, thank you very much. And that's very exciting news. And hopefully solar will spread more and we'll get more cheaper electric. Brilliant. David Saunders, thank you very much.
Thanks, John.
So I've got Julius Abraham on the line. You're involved in comedy in many various ways. I understand you're a compere of various nights around the city that people may have seen.
Yeah, I started out making short sketches for BBC Three, ITV2, and documentaries for Channel 4. And then I just, they trained me, the BBC, in drama and comedy. And I just thought that I would use my skills out on the street, so to speak.
Okay.
And run my own comedy venues.
Okay, brilliant. What are you running a venue at the moment?
I am. I used to do stand-up with Russell Howard and Justin Lee Collins at Jester's, and now I have a night every Thursday, 9 p.m. at the Old England, which is Montpellier, 43 Bath Buildings, BS65PT. Have I bugged that enough?
Okay, yeah, I think so, yeah.
Well, over Christmas, I'll still be running the Old England, Montpellier, BS65PT, and I'll also be running the Arts House. The Arts House is finished because that's every first Wednesday of the month, so that will start in the new year on the 11th, I think it is.
Okay.
Yeah, I enjoy the art stuff. I enjoy the old England slightly more because it's a bit more rowdy and raucous crowd, and I play up to them, get them to play games. We have a joke competition. We have rap battles. There's music as well.
A lot
of people don't think they'll like the rap battles, but they do because it's all about the punchlines.
Okay, so they're sort of like one-liners, but in a sort of a rap style sort of a thing.
That's it, yeah. It's like two or four verses. You can go for four verses. Then you pass the mic, and then the other person has a chance to insult you, your family, and whoever they want. You have to be quite thick-skinned because it is funny to the audience, but some members can take it quite seriously.
Okay. What do you make of the success of your previous colleagues, Justin Lee Collins and Mr. Howard?
Well, I'm happy for Russell Howard. He worked really, really hard. I think he's teetotal, doesn't really drink, and he concentrated on his humour quite intensely to be where he is now. Justin Lee Collins, just an all-round, really likeable guy, and he did the BBC Comedy Awards. He was the compere, and they chose him. All the acts that presented their work weren't chosen. He was chosen, and all he was doing was hosting it, which was quite funny, really.
What comedy do you like to watch on TV that you think is good at the moment?
What do I like watching?
Yeah.
I really liked How Not to Live Your Life. That was on BBC Three. That's finished now. I watched The Inbetweeners. They're all right. They are quite funny. IT Crowd I really like.
Yeah.
I think that's mostly repeat. I love really like quite close to the knuckle stuff, like
Sort of black comedy.
Balls of Steel.
Okay. So like sort of things in the vein of black comedy.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Balls of Steel, Phone Jacker, absolutely love those. They're some of my favourite and best comedies.
A lot of people say the golden age of the sitcom is past. I mean, do you think that's true? What do you think has happened to the state of sitcom on TV?
I think they are right. Comedy needs to come in a different format. The easy sitcom kind of setting, like How Not to Live Your Life is a sitcom, but it's brilliantly done and it's cutting edge, and that's the good thing about it. Little Miss Jocelyn, that was brilliant. That was on BBC Two. I thought she was really good and really up to date and cutting edge. There aren't any sitcoms around at the moment. That I think Friends, that was massive, but is there ever going to be anything like that again?
Well, who knows? I mean, we're all often told in terms of music that obviously the internet is the future and you can all set up your MySpace page, but do you think the same applies to comedy in the same way?
That the internet has made it accessible, too accessible, that people don't really want to buy into a weekly sitcom? Good question. I think the answer to that is yes. People do like watching Live at the Apollo.
Yeah,
Lee Evans, Jack B, brilliant comics. Very easily accessible.
I remember Lee Hurst recently in the news, in the past year at least, who used to be on a BBC quiz show, not A Question of Sport, the other one. He does organise his own stand-up night and got so cross with people videoing his acts on their mobile phones and then uploading it onto the internet so everybody could watch it for free that he basically grabbed some phone, a phone out of a guy's hand and threw it on the floor. I mean, what do you think about that? Would you get cross if people were videoing your acts and putting it up on the internet for free and so they're not going to turn up?
I wouldn't get cross at the moment because I don't have agents and companies involved in trying to generate money for me, so it would be advertisement really for myself. But I can see why he got really angry with that, and I did hear about that, and I was thinking, wow, did the guy get up and thump him one, or what happened?
I'm afraid we've got to sort of wrap things up, but remind people what nights you're organising and when they are and when people can come.
Okay, so at the moment, I've got two nights, one every single Thursday. That's at the Old England, 43 Bath Buildings, Montpellier, BS6, 5PT.
Okay.
That is every Thursday, 9 p.m, and it's free to get in.
Brilliant.
Totally free. And the other one's Arts House. That's 9 p.m, every first Wednesday of the month. Arts House is on Stokes Croft. That's free to get in as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Julius Abraham, thank you very much, and have a good Christmas and New Year.
Yeah, you as well, John. Thank you. Thank you for the call.
Dialect Radio is forging ahead with links with a community radio station in Colombia. The station in question is called Picnic Medellin. In this interview, you are going to hear Antar Karana, a Colombian musician, talking about his art project with children that he established in botanical gardens in England and Scotland.
Hola, bueno, y pues y agradeciendo la invitación que me están... Well, in depth, the work of Tambora and Tambora Foundation and the group of people that are together weaving this dream involves as well weaving the botanical gardens. It's been really interesting to see the reactions of people because it seems like botanical gardens is the last place where people will ever think about weaving something, because mainly people don't even know where the botanical gardens are. Like, I've been talking with people about where the botanical gardens are in Bristol. Is there a botanical gardens in Bristol? Many people don't even know. And that happens in many cities. And in Colombia, about 14 years ago, one of the elders from the Amazon, from the tribe, he planted a maloca, or a sacred heart, right in the heart of the botanical garden, with the purpose of awakening the seed of the Muisca people, which is the big tribe that the anthropologist says that they die and they were all wiped out, but actually the seed was just still alive and waiting to be watered, to sprout. So that's what happened, and that's been evolving. So therefore, we've been doing different projects weaving at the moment the Botanical Gardens of Edinburgh, the Royal Botanics, and then with the botanics in Colombia, in Bogota. And then now, as I'm kind of doing more work in Bristol, I live in Bristol and I've been traveling all over the UK all the time. So I feel now is the time to settle a bit more in Bristol and start doing more work here. So now we are doing steps, really amazing steps forward with the botanics in Bristol to start connecting not only Edinburgh, but Bristol and Colombia. And the dream is going on and on, weaving more botanics on the way. And basically all we want to do is recognizing botanical gardens not only as a sort of museum where people just go and see plants and pay for it to see them, but just to recognize that plants means ancestry. Ancestry means traditions. And in many of the countries, tradition has been lost. They are like the seed I just mentioned. They are just waiting to be watered, to be alive again. So we are hoping with this work to inspire people to reconnect to their ancestry. For my main vision about doing this in England or in Scotland is not only about bringing Colombian stuff, but about, as I said, people getting inspired with their own traditions and their own ancestry here in these lands. Hopefully that will happen by seeing how happy we feel by cultivating our traditions and our culture. Yeah, I think that's the main.
So does it involve art of any sort?
It does involve art, mainly art and music. So we are also doing lots of work related to the awareness of sound, the sound therapy, how sound works, and because all this work comes from different ancestral cultures as well. This comes from not only from Tibet, but also from China. Absolutely different parts, and also I'm blending it with traditions from the place I'm from. So we are doing, in concrete, there's a project called Hands for Life, for example. With what we do is we got a group of children in Colombia and a group of children in England. Then as they can't communicate to each other because of the language, then we put the same topic for 4 weekends, same topic in both lands, and then we exchange the drawings. So they start having a friend abroad, and they start getting to know their friend by their art they produce. So the topics are, for example, the first one will be about myself, the second one will be about my city, the third one will be my favorite places, the fourth one could be my family or my best friends. So they start getting to know each other, and they start sending messages, and the whole thing that triggers is incredible. it's a process that you can't really know exactly how it's going to unfold. But I did an interview with them, some of the guys. We did this work with learning difficulties as well, learning difficulties here and learning difficulties in Colombia. You get responses like, oh, I want to learn Spanish, oh, I want to learn English, oh, I want to travel to the UK, oh, I want to travel to Colombia, all such responses. So yeah, it's unfolding to a way that we, at the moment, we don't really know how it's going to go, but all we know is that they are really happy to know and to get a friend somewhere else. And yeah, the more we see the people happy, then the more content that we can keep working.
So do you have a website?
We do have a website, which is www.tamborafoundation.org, which is a foundation website. Or if people want to see as well about the work related to sound and sound healing and all that stuff, is www.tribalsoundhealing.com.
That was Anthea Page talking to Antar Carano, a Colombian musician living in Bristol. And hello to our listeners on Radio Picnic Medellin in Colombia. Adios.
As the financial crisis bites and businesses find themselves having to slim down to survive, there is a temptation for bosses to take shortcuts and, rather than sacking people officially, make their lives so difficult at work that they have to leave of their own volition. This can cut down enormously on the cost of sacking someone, but it's also known as constructive dismissal and is actionable by an employment tribunal. It's just one example of bullying. Bullying can and does go on anywhere. Anywhere that is, except on the Bristol Bully Watch helpline. And I'm joined now by Julie Oakley, whose voice you're likely to hear at the other end. Hello, Julie.
Hello.
Thank you for joining me. Why was the helpline set up in the first place?
The helpline was set up in 2001 after my daughter, that was then 15, tried to commit suicide due to being bullied. You do the usual things. You go to school, you try to get them to listen and find out what the issue was. But unfortunately, it wasn't dealt with in a way that I thought was acceptable. And at the time, I obviously knew that there were organisations based in London that dealt with bullying, but there was nothing local. What I really wanted was someone that I could talk to locally that would sit with me and almost empathise of what they'd been through, and it would help me to know where to go next. It wasn't anything like that at the time, so Bully Watch was formed from that. I'm in an enviable position in a way, because in some cases I can work with the three main streams, which is the bully, the victim and the bystander, to enable to get a complete result, and also work with the parents as well.
What kind of types of calls do you get on a daily basis?
On a daily basis, usually the calls I get are not ones that have been one-off, and obviously we have to make sure that the definition of bullying is correct as well, usually where it's persistent and hurtful, because one-offs usually people deal with themselves. But when it's persistent and you've got a parent that's tried everything, you know, gone to school on numerous occasions because of certain issues, whether it be physical or it could be cyberbullying, because that's a 24/7 one now, or one of the other, social exclusion, you have to support them with the system. You have to find out what they've done, what has come back to them via the school, or sometimes it's in organisations, not always school, and then work out where you go next. You know, it could be that they've done everything with the school, they've seen the teachers, they've seen the head, and then it could be that they need to go to the education department and talk to them. But it's not so much about that, it's about the young person, about their confidence, their esteem and how they feel and what they want to happen. Because I've sat with young people that have really not wanted to go through the system. All they wanted is for it to stop.
So could you give us a specific example of a call that you've had?
One particular call, that was another attempted suicide, where they've literally gone back to school and they weren't in a position to get the help that they needed. The school was completely in denial that there was a particular problem, and the outcome was in the end that they were out of school for quite a few months having mental health care, which if school had looked at the problem in the beginning and dealt with it, then it would have had a different outcome. But we shouldn't be leaving it until it gets to that stage.
And how did you help that individual?
We started right at the beginning. We built the confidence of the young person, along with obviously some medical help, because it's child mental health at the end. But we helped build the esteem and confidence of that child by building their skills and looking at strategies of things that they can do themselves to protect themselves. Because we all know that bullying is about a power over somebody. And what you've got to try and do is take that power away from them.
So you mentioned there that schools sometimes are in denial about bullying issues, which in terms of pupils who potentially are about to commit suicide, that's clearly not the case. How can they be allowed to do this?
I could go back and think about a policeman that rang me from Manchester, because we take calls from all over the country. And he rang me and he said that he had this particular problem in the area and that they were in denial. And he would go and see this particular head on more than one occasion because parents have contacted him because of various issues, physical bullying, cyberbullying. And he was getting nowhere because she was saying that they did not have a problem in her school with bullying. And so I said, leave it with me and I'll come back to you. I'll have to have a think about it. So I rang him back and I said, look, what we need to do on this one is for you to go back and speak to her and say, look, you've obviously got a really good anti-bullying policy and you're obviously doing very well. Would you go back and do a presentation in the area to all the other schools so that they could do the same as what you're doing? So he did. He went back to her and she said, well, maybe we do have some issues that maybe need to be looked at. So she had to back down because he put her in a corner.
But it must be very scary in a way when the system itself is denying that there are problems, and you as an individual are kind of you listen on the end of the phone and you try and give people actions, but you know there must be a frustration there on your part.
It is very frustrating. Don't get me wrong, there are some schools that do a really fantastic job, and that, you know, I've met some really good people that are working on this issue, but there are some schools that are really still, you know, frustrating me, because there are, every school is going to have an element of bullying. And we have to remember that.
It's a complex problem, and schools are so often becoming part of a child's like emotional care. And I can imagine that it is very difficult when those elements start to bleed into the school day. But that is part and parcel of their job now. So, I mean, would you say there needs to be more training for schools and head teachers and people like that?
Yeah, there does need to be more training, especially with new NQT teachers. They need more training.
Just to clarify, that's kind of newly qualified
teacher. Yeah, sorry. Okay. Yeah, they need more training on how to deal with bullying incidents and how to look out for it as well. You know, sometimes it's not obvious. So, yeah, definitely more training, and definitely more money needs to be put into it as well by government, because it's one of the biggest issues. It's still about 1 in 5 young people that are still getting bullied.
And obviously that's a massive problem for the future for everyone.
Well, the people that we don't challenge in the classroom, or younger people, are the ones that probably get away with it and do the bullying in the workplace later on.
How can you tell if you're being bullied? Because there's an element of paranoia in understanding objectively, am I being bullied, or is it just that person's not having a very good day, for example?
If it's something that's being persistent and it's happening on more than one occasion, it's likely it could be. If you're thinking of sort of in the workplace, you have to think of all the sort of aspects of whether it could be something you're being asked to do that you've not been trained to do. So they're forcing you to do something or putting yourself in a situation that you shouldn't be in because you've not had the training for it. You also have to be aware of constructive criticism and that you're not being ultra sensitive. It can be very difficult, but to be honest, if someone is upsetting you, it's always best to look at it as being bullying, because you can always change it later. But if someone's coming to you and say they're being bullied, I think you need to look at it as a bullying situation, because that person may never come back to you again if you don't do something about it.
That's true. It is such a loaded term, though. It's so serious when you say, I'm being bullied. There's a massive personal acceptance of that fact for yourself. So, like you say, people probably wouldn't come forward again. However, like you mentioned there, people, you would advise people to say, if you're upset, that is bullying. That is equally a very serious kind of allegation,
it
really,
is,
isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it is. And you have to be very careful because of the legal side of these things, because we have to be careful because we do label people. in certain categories, you know, like I said earlier on, the bystander, the victim, and obviously the bully. So we do have to be careful. But if it is something that's really upsetting, then it needs to be looked at, whether it's classed as bullying or classed as being something that's not acceptable.
So you would advise people to talk to someone? And
absolutely, yeah, because we can all make a mistake. But if it's upsetting somebody, then you should really talk about it.
Okay, thank you. In terms of, obviously, you're a small charity, I presume you're a charity.
No, we're not a charity, we're a non-profit project group.
Okay, but in terms of donations, for example, you must be struggling at the moment with the economic downturn we're experiencing at the moment.
Completely struggling. I would say that if we reach Christmas, it'll be great. It's that the times we're in at the moment are very difficult.
So in terms of just day-to-day surviving, let alone putting on events, it's very difficult.
It is very difficult, yeah, for a small group like ours, yeah.
How can people help?
Well, they can help by, they can donate to us via, obviously, the website. They can do some fundraising for us. We'll accept anything, literally.
Okay. Well, what is your website? Just
it's www.bullywatch.org.
Okay, so people can go on there, they can donate, they can offer some of their time. Do you take volunteers, for example?
We do take volunteers, yeah.
And provide training?
Yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned to me earlier that you've won the local Pride of Britain Award for the South West.
I did, yes.
And that's presumably for your work with bullying.
It was for my community work with it on anti-bullying, yes.
Okay, wow, so that's an amazing achievement. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, it was the Pride of Britain. It was actually in October, that was in London from the Grosvenor Hotel. We were part of that, and obviously I received an award for my work. And we met the celebrities, and yeah.
Okay, so did you get nominated by someone you knew?
Yeah, nominated by someone in the family, yeah.
That's fantastic. So it's probably a good idea if we actually give the number of bully, the bully outline.
It's 01454 318 753.
And what's your website again?
It's www.bullywatch.org.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for talking to me, Julie. And please do go on to the website, and any donations, I'm sure, that gratefully received.
Time for some poetry, and it's my pleasure to introduce Mark Sayers to the studio. Hello.
Hello. My first poem is about my Aunt Betty, who died recently, aged 99. She was a most fascinating lady who'd been one of the first lady pursers with Cunard and had been in the wartime Wrens. She also had a holiday flat in France. Will she think of those left behind? This Christmas, Betty won't be here, but in the happy hunting ground. Surely it must beat a care home, sitting surrounded, but alone. TV and groans, the only sounds, and none of her relations near. She made the best of her last years after a life so full of fun and danger, with the wartime Wrens. Then Cunard, which paid dividends, Noel Coward, the Atlantic run, the Royals, film stars, rogues and peers. She knuckled down and had to share her bedroom with a nice old dear. Yet she'd shared cabins years ago on cruise ships sailing to and fro. Now that she's reached the famed frontier of the next world, I'll say a prayer that she enjoys her Christmas there, with parents, siblings and old friends from days at sea, the south of France. Fine food and wines, the chance to dance with Fred Astaire. Let's hope she spends her days and nights letting her hair down when she's not meeting the saints, Augustine, Hilda, Thomas More, laughing with angels. Seems to me you're all so happy and carefree. Please take me with you when you soar, all worshipping without constraints. Will she recall those who were kind, the care home staff smiling away, that sea view from the front window which cheered her up when feeling low, trying to enjoy their Christmas day? Will she think of those left behind?
Thank you very much. I think we may have time for one more. Do you have a...
This is based on a pier which Sir John Betjeman said was the most beautiful in England.
Wonderful.
And it's a stone's throw from Bristol, Clevedon Pier. The prettiest of piers. so elegant, in such good taste. In fact, a real seaside delight, a gem, doubtless Clevedon's highlight. We stroll and glimpse a bygone age of horses, carriages, less haste, before grim world wars held the stage. Yes, Clevedon Pier is such a dear. For 130 years, known as the prettiest of piers, day to day tender, loving care is needed for this dainty pier to surmount time and tide's harsh wear. A pagoda floats out at sea, which has been lovingly restored after disaster struck and gnawed those graceful iron supports away. The Preservation's Trust decree, our much-loved piers not had its day. Dismantled, yet somehow repaired, and with great care now reinstalled. Most beautiful, she has been called, a labour of love without doubt, our pride and joy. Bless those who cared and saw doomed merchants put to rout.
Mark says, thank you very much.
Yes.
So if people enjoy your poetry and perhaps sort of want to do something similar or get involved, do you go along to any poetry groups or something like that people
yeah,
can go to?
Yes, I do. I run my own group, which is called the Portcullis Poets, which meets usually on the second Thursday of the month in Eugenie House, the first three houses of Royal York Crescent. But what I would suggest people do is look up the Poetry Can website. Every month, Poetry Can produce a newsletter, mm-hmm. and they put all the events that are on with groups who meet in Bristol or Bath or wherever is in that newsletter.
Okay. And all the appropriate contact details.
Yeah, that's what I would suggest.
Okay, so if we put in Poetry Can into your favoured search engine...
Indeed.
That will take you to that website.
Indeed. And there are also groups that meet in Wells, in Weston-super-Mare, in Bath, in Bradford-on-Avon. There are, you know, countless groups meeting, apart from all over Bristol.
Poetry enthusiasts, you have no excuse. Mark Sayers, thank you very much. Have a good Christmas.
You.
Treasure Island by Scottish author Robert Louis Stevenson was first published in its entirety on the 23rd of May, 1883. Much of the action takes place in 17th century English taverns and bars, in case you didn't know this, some of which are believed to be based on pubs which still exist today. Brislington's Hole in the Wall may be Stevenson's model for his Spyglass Tavern, some have speculated, and the Landlord Trail on King Street in town, or city centre I should say, is often claimed to be the inspiration for Stevenson's Admiral Benbow. This may be a myth, because there is in fact an Admiral Benbow in Penzance and Cornwall, which is of a similar era to the book, so that has an arguably better claim. But anyway, without further ado, Malcolm Grieve reads this week's episode of Treasure Island.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 6, Captain Silver. Chapter 28, In the Enemy's Camp. I stopped, for I could tell you I was out of breath, and to my wonder, not a man of them moved. They all sat staring at me like as many sheep. And while they were still staring, I broke out again. "And now, Mr. Silver," I said, "I believe you're the best man here, and if things go the worst, I'll take it kind of you to let the doctor know the way I took it."
"I'll bear it in mind," said Silver, with an accent so curious that I could not for the life of me decide whether he were laughing at my request or had been favourably affected by my courage.
"I'll put one to that," cried the old mahogany-faced seaman, Morgan by name, whom I had seen in Long John's public house on the quays of Bristol. "It was him that knowed Black Dog."
"Well, and see here," added the sea cook, "I'll put another again to that, by thunder, for it was this same boy that faked the chart from Billy Bones. First and last,
we've split upon Jim Hawkins. Then here goes, said Morgan with an oath, and he sprang up, drawing his knife as if he had been 20. Avast there, cried Silver. Who are you, Tom Morgan? Maybe you thought you was captain here. Perhaps. By the powers, but I'll teach you better. Cross me and you'll go where many a good man's gone before you, first and last, these 30 year back. Some to the yardarm, shiver my sides, and some by the board, and all to feed the fishes. There's never a man looked me between the eyes and seen a good day afterwards, Tom Morgan. And you may lay to that. Morgan paused, but a hoarse murmur arose from the others. Tom's right, said one. I stood hazing long enough from one, added another. I'll be hanged if I'll be hazed by you, John Silver. Did any of you gentlemen want to have it out with me? Roared Silver, bending far forward from his position on the keg, with his pipe still glowing in his right hand. Put a name on what you're at. You ain't dumb, I reckon. Him that wants shall get it. Have I lived this many years and a son of a rum punch and cock his hat athwart my halls at the latter end of it? You know the way. You're all gentlemen of fortune by your account. Well, I'm ready. Take a cutlass, him that dares, and I'll see the colour of his insides, crutch and all, before that pipe's empty. Not a man stirred. Not a man answered. That's your sort, is it? He added, returning his pipe to his mouth. Well, you're a gay lot to look at, anyway. Not much worth to fight. You ain't. Perhaps you can understand King George's English? I'm cap'n here because I'm the best man by a long sea mile. You won't fight as gentlemen of fortune should. Then by thunder you'll obey, and you may lay to it. I like that boy now. I never seen a better boy than that. He's more a man than any pair of rats of you in this here house. And what I say is this. Let me see him that'll lay a hand on him. That's what I say. And you may lay to it. There was a long pause after this. I stood straight up against the wall, my heart still going like a sledgehammer, but with a ray of hope now shining in my bosom. Silver leant back against the wall, his arms crossed, his pipe in the corner of his mouth, as calm as though he had been in a church. Yet his eye kept wandering furtively, and he kept the tail of it on his unruly followers. They, on their part, drew gradually together towards the far end of the blockhouse, and the low hiss of their whispering sounded in my ear continuously like a stream. One after another, they would look up, and the red light of the torch would fall for a second on their nervous faces. But it was not towards me, it was towards Silver that they turned their eyes. You seem to have a lot to say, remarked Silver, spitting far into the air. Pipe up and let me hear it, or lay to. Ax your pardon, sir, returned one of the men. You're pretty free with some of the rules. Maybe you'll kindly keep an eye upon the rest. This crew's dissatisfied. This crew don't value bullying and a marlin spike. This crew has its rights like other crews. I'll make so free as that. And by your rules, I take it we can talk together. I ax your pardon, sir, acknowledging you to be captain at present. But I claim my right and steps outside for a council. And with an elaborate sea salute, this fellow, a long, ill-looking, yellow-eyed man of 35, stepped coolly towards the door and disappeared out of the longhouse. One after another, the rest followed his example, each making a salute as he passed, each adding some apology. According to rules, said one.
Foxhall Council, said Morgan.
And so, with one remark or another, all marched out, and left Silver and me alone with the torch. The sea cook instantly removed his pipe. Now you look here, Jim Hawkins, he said, in a steady whisper that was no more than audible. You're within half a plank of death, and what's a sight worse? Of torture. They're going to throw me off. But you mark, I stand by you through thick and thin. I didn't mean to. No, not till you spoke up. I was about desperate to lose that much blunt and be hanged into the bargain. But I see you was the right sort. I says to myself,
You stand by Hawkins, John, and Hawkins will stand by you. You're his last card. And by the living thunder, John, he's yours. Back to back, says I. You save your witness, and he'll save your neck. I began dimly to understand. You mean, all's lost? I asked. Aye, by gum, I do. Ship gone, neck gone. That's the size of it. Once I looked into that bay, Jim Hawkins, and I see no schooner. Well, I'm tough, but I gave out. As for that lot and their council, mark me, they're outright fools and cowards. I'll save your life, if so be as I can, from them. But see here, Jim, tit for tat. You save Long John from swinging. I was bewildered. It seemed a thing so hopeless he was asking. He, the old buccaneer, the ringleader throughout. What I can do, that I'll do, I said. It's a bargain, cried Long John. You speak up, Plucky, and by thunder, I've a chance. He hobbled to the torch, where it stood propped among the firewood, and took a fresh light to his pipe. Understand me, Jim, he said, returning. I've a head on my shoulders, I have. I'm on Squire's side now. I know you've got that ship safe somewhere. How you done it, I don't know, but safe it is. I guess Hans and O'Brien turned soft. I never much believed in neither of them. Now you mark me. I ask no questions, nor I won't let others. I know when a game's up, I do, and I know a lad that's staunch. Ah, you that's young. You and me might have done a power of good together. He drew some cognac from the cask into a tin canikin. Will you taste, messmate? He asked. And when I had refused, well, I'll take a drain myself, Jim, said he. I need a corker, for there's trouble on hand. And talking of trouble, why did that doctor give me the chart, Jim? My face expressed a wonder so unaffected that he saw the needlessness of further questions. Ah, well, he did, though, and there's something under that, no doubt. Something surely under that, Jim. Bad or good. And he took another swallow of the brandy, shaking his great fair head like a man who looks forward to the worst.
Thank you very much to Malcolm Grieve, as ever, and to the late Robert Louis Stevenson for writing Treasure Island. This is courtesy of Jess Barks. Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, December the 23rd, the Rolling Zones will be performing at the Victoria in Victoria Road, Swindon. Tickets are £8 in advance, and the doors open at 8. Also on December the 23rd, Glam Harry will be performing at the Fiddlers in Woolway Street, Bristol. Tickets are again £8 in advance, and the doors open at 8. On to the Song of the Week, and I present Pentangle. This group formed in 1967 and split up in 73, and then in 81 they reformed with a slightly different lineup and have been performing and recording new material to this day. This particular song is titled Market Song and is from the album Sweet Child, which was released in 1968.
As I walk market, each day I can hear them cry, sweeter apples, sweeter oranges, sweeter apples, sweeter oranges, fresh, fresh for sale for you out today. Come and buy. Walking through the storm. across the sea. And the sweet apples, sweet oranges, sweet apples, sweet oranges. I hear the cries of the beggar paradise. My sweet apples, sweet oranges, come and buy them. Through the forest I can see them, hanging there so ripe and red.
That was Pentangle with Market Song from the album Sweet Child. For more information, you can check pentangle.info. Keeping with Friday, December the 23rd, there is some ska action courtesy of the Imperials, and that's at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol. Entry is £5 on the door, and the doors open at 8. Finally, on Sunday, December the 25th, if you haven't fallen asleep in front of the TV, there is a Community Christmas Day Celebrations with Dan Moore of Phantom Limb, Katie Tucker, formerly of She Creatures, going on at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Entry is free, and the doors open at 12 noon. That's all from Jeff and me doing the What's On. Thank you very much for listening. Have a good week. Take care. Goodbye, he says. Okay, so time to hand over very briefly to Tony Gosling, who also has a few leaflets and bits and bobs of info as to what's going on.
Well, I've got one main leaflet, John, and that's one I picked up at the Cathedral. This is just really running through some of the choral concerts and things there are over the Christmas season, because really, I mean, they've got a fantastic choir in there. If you fancy some live music and live singing rather than blobbing out in front of the TV or listening to radio, it's a fantastic acoustic in the Cathedral too. So there is some all sorts of stuff going on. Wednesday the 21st of December, that's next Wednesday, is 6:30 p.m. is the Nativité Messiaen, that's singing. Then Friday the 23rd of December at 7 o'clock in the evening, it's a service of 9 lessons and carols, which is classic Christmas sort of mixture of a few Bible readings, but mostly singing and some carols. Then 3:30 on Saturday 24th of December, that's Christmas Eve, that's again the service of 9 lessons and carols. Midnight Mass, 11:30 p.m. on Christmas Eve. And on Sunday the 25th of December, that's Christmas Day, several services. There's a 8 o'clock in the morning, actually no, 7:45 in the morning, if you're up that early on Christmas Day.
Okay.
There's Matins, Holy Communion at 8, the Eucharist Festival with an orchestra at 10 a.m. on Christmas Day, and an evening prayer at the Crib at 3:30 p.m. Friday the 6th of January, they have Epiphany, which is a sung Eucharist, and an Epiphany Tide procession, finally, on Sunday the 8th of January. And also, not to forget, if you've got youngsters particularly who are interested in singing, then there is a special group for children aged between 8 and 13 years old. Bring them along to Bristol Cathedral Choir School. I mean, it's one of the best choir schools in the country, so they'll get fantastic training if they're interested in doing a bit of singing. No audition, just either pick up the leaflets at the Cathedral, or they're online at bristolvoices.co.uk. And you can contact Jane English on 07752 332278. That's 07752 332278 for young people between 8 and 13 who are interested in learning to sing with some of the best in the country.
Okay, thank you, Tony. And also, if you're bored on Boxing Day, the punk band The Members are playing at the Fleece and Firkin in St Thomas Street in Bristol.
Quite a contrast to the lesson, five lessons and carols,
isn't it? Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Sunday afternoon at 2 p.m. We also go out on Preston FM and in St Albans on Radio Verulam. If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website, dialectsradio.co.uk. Thank you very much to our studio guests, David Saunders and Mark Sayers. Reports this week were Anthony Page and Tony Gosling, and the studio production this week was by Michael Noyce. We also had Jeff Sparks' What's On Guide, as written by him but read by me, and the producer this week was Tony Gosling. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production. Anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect. I'm John Peters Coleman, wishing you a very good week. And remember, if it's about 1 a.m. and you see a strange man in a red suit creeping around your house, call the police.
Did you ever stop to notice this crying earth, this weeping?